creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Conspiracy theories, propaganda, social media, and the denial of scientific theory are all playing a role in the rise of anti-intellectualism in the U.S. Today on Culture Click, we examine anti-intellectualism with guests Scott Olson, Winona State University President, Amanda Brower, Professor of Psychology, and Adam Gaffey, Professor of Communication Studies. Learn what anti-intellectualism is, why it might be on the rise in the U.S., and what might be done about it. I'm Bill Stoneberg, and this is Culture Click. I'm here with Scott Olson, Winona State University President, Amanda Brower, Professor of Psychology, and Adam Gaffey, Professor of Communication Studies. Thanks for being on the show with us today, everyone.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Okay, great. Well, first off, can you explain a little bit of, for our listeners, what anti-intellectualism is? Who wants to take that one?
Well, there's a history in the United States, goes back to a book by Richard Hofstadter written in 1962 that sort of defines anti-intellectualism as kind of organized, intentional dislike or contempt of the life of the mind. Okay. And then doing things to denigrate it or stand in the way of it.
Okay, okay. How far back does anti-intellectualism go in the U.S.?
Yeah. Well, I suppose...
Or does it come and go in different waves?
It certainly goes in waves, but I suspect that for the entire history of this republic and well before that, throughout all human history, okay, human beings... being who we are,
right,
psychologically, now that's Amanda's expertise, but sure, human beings being who we are, there have always been people who disparage the life of the mind. How organized they are and how forceful they are about it, I suppose, ebbs and flows. But sure, I suspect that that's pretty baked into human behavior.
Okay, okay. Well, since it isn't a new trend, why do you think that it's on the rise in today's society?
In today's society, for yeah, contemporary? Well, that's one of the questions we were kind of thinking about as a panel. I mean, it's always a contextual thing, but if you have sort of forces or undercurrents that are trying to undermine people who have opinions or attitudes or conclusions that are informed, I mean, and that could be any indication of anti-intellectualism. One of the strange things about the 21st century is we've got so much information and not always a common set of facts. So without a common set of facts to hold from, it's possible for people to be holding different attitudes about the world that are completely opposed to each other. So that's one thing that you could say is just a contributing factor for why we are talking about it now and why it comes up now.
Okay, okay. Is this something that just the U.S. faces, or is this on the rise elsewhere in the world, do you think?
I certainly think that it's not just the United States. I think that in response to any kind of drive of new thought, there are always going to be those that might, you know, go against it. So, for example, the claim between childhood vaccinations and autism caused parents in the UK to also decide not to get immunizations for right, their children. So it's certainly not is just something that's unique to the United States.
Okay, okay. What is?
Let me just jump in on what you
sure,
was saying. That's an interesting phenomenon because, from the, you can see anti-intellectualism coming from all different points of the political ideological spectrum. So, opposition to vaccination is found among kind of liberal progressive elites in California. Whereas maybe opposition to teaching evolution or teaching certain things at a university might come from the political right. So it isn't, this doesn't just sort of come from one direction or exist in one society at one point in time.
Right.
And you might see evidence in a rise in nationalism internationally. Around the world, Brexit in the UK could be an example of folks kind of voting against what kind of objective evidence might and good argument might suggest would be in their own self-interest and the interest of the rest of their nation, but instead going into a place that was sort of what felt right for them at that point in time. So yeah, I think there is evidence of it occurring in other points around the world right at the moment.
Okay. And you kind of touched on going against what is best for them, you know, because they don't know, I suppose.
Well, I don't think there's a shortage of information one way or the other about, you know, vaccination or Brexit.
Right.
It is, well, this is a man's expertise again, but I think it might go to confirmation bias and go to folks kind of having already decided what they believe to be true about something and then only seeking things that reaffirm what they already believe to be true. Like, I believe sticking needles in my baby is bad for my baby, and so now I will seek out information that confirms that belief rather than maybe contradictory information that tells me that my baby's going to be much healthier if from time to time a needle gets stuck into my baby. Is that fair, Amanda?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. You want to elaborate on that, Amanda?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was really well summarized in the sense that, you know, when people are approaching new information that doesn't fit with their current worldviews or their current sense of self, or even current information that they haven't known before, they tend to seek out information that really, in a sense, confirms that. And so that makes it difficult then when new information is presented to them to really latch on to that and be able to process that in a way that can help them really critically think about this alternative option or this alternative form of science that I hadn't been, you know, encountered before.
I'm curious if Adam would say, too, at the same time, we don't have many people maybe aren't equipped with good tools for evaluating what a good argument is or a bad argument. So they're not well equipped to kind of listen to somebody arguing about vaccinations or Brexit and being able to kind of critically think about that and say, that doesn't logically follow from that point or that's not a good piece of evidence. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that is fair. And I mean, just so one quick point about the Brexit thing that I think is just an interesting fact or anecdote and then to that point, but the National Public Radio had a story about Brexit, and they found that according to what Google had published in their search engine, the most common search term after the Brexit vote in the UK was Brexit. What is Brexit? So trying to understand this thing that we just made this major decision on, and again, you know, that might be, you know, kind of just fragmented or one bit of data, but it's telling if that is indeed the case. One of the things that...
It's like I just bought this boat. I just wonder if there's some water around here.
Yeah. Right.
Could somebody tell me what I just committed to. So yeah, I mean, our argumentation is kind of, I think, a way of sort of not only understanding what you believe about the world, but trying to get into somebody else's worldview to test and make sure that can be confirmed.
Okay.
So, I mean, I like to tell students that, you know, if they have a topic, we study it from at least two angles because we don't know quite as much about one if we don't compare it to the other. And hopefully in that process of comparison, we not only learn more about ourselves, but, you know, we can admit if somebody else has good, verifiable, and credible reason that we can change our mind. And so we can be swayed from mistakes if we sort of commit to that mindset that I'm human, I'm fallible, I don't have all the answers, but if I'm curious, I'm going to explore this from a couple different possibilities and see what I can come up with.
Right. Stay open to new information and
right. So I mean, the way I mentioned it in the talk was you have to embrace doubt without being rudderless. So it's not as though there are no standards for what counts as a good argument, but it is to say that understanding those standards becomes the way to sort of understanding what you believe and what you value and what we should do so that we're not just jumping into something without thinking it through.
Okay. Do you think that in today's society that social media plays a part in the rise of anti-intellectualism? Maybe this one for you, Amanda.
Yeah, I definitely do think that it plays in some way, but not so much in the rise of anti-intellectualism, but in the rise in how we process our information or the exposure that we have to certain information. So if we are biased towards seeing information that confirms our beliefs, it becomes difficult then to, as Ben was saying, you know, engage in an alternative perspective and consider, you know, an alternative direction or another side of the argument, because we will only see then or only engage or respond to stuff that fits with our particular worldview or fits with the information that we know. That lends itself to what we call in psychology sort of this top-down processing, where when we take in information that is simple or easy or contextual because we have so much information available to us, and we fail to really consider what we call bottom-up processing, where we can critically think about the arguments and really look at both ends of it or consider an alternative perspective. And so social media in its sort of quick getcha slide through kind of approach prevents us from really looking at all of those angles in a way that's a sort of healthful approach to learning new information.
Okay. And I know, Adam, you mentioned a little bit in the discussion, but do you think the current political climate, the current administration possibly, has played a role in the rise of anti-intellectualism?
Well, so it's tempting to say yes, but I'm gonna exercise some restraint. I think that the current administration has a lot of problems about how we think about thoughtful or careful deliberation. But I wouldn't credit the Trump administration with fostering the rise. I think they're more so a symptom. I think
causality may flow the other way.
Right. I think you could look at people like Trump who offer really easy, really misinformed ideas about the world, and he's getting a response, and that seems to be more of a system that I would argue has devalued argumentation or devalued practical reasoning, and then that's kind of the result that we get. So Trump's presidency will eventually come and go. It might be done in 7 years or 3 years or 3 months, but whatever is left, I mean, we still have this culture and this attitude toward the intellect or practical reasoning that is going to determine our future.
Okay.
So don't you think social media, how many characters are you allowed in a tweet, doesn't lend itself to nuanced long-form argument?
It's harder.
Right. It's sort of it's very effective at conveying emotion, a feeling, an attitude. But given its brevity, it doesn't lend itself to really any kind of nuance or, well, gee, maybe this, but kind of also this.
It perpetuates that sort of automatic form of thinking rather than that controlled, effortful thinking. I see something that happens in two statements. Oh, that's the end, right? Whereas, you know, maybe there's an alternative perspective to that that needs more time to be hashed out. And that consequently, I think, also fits into that confirmation bias we were talking about earlier. That makes it harder then to process new information differently.
Well, the other thing about social media compared to, say, the traditional media is social media, one is opting in to certain things that they seek, right? So I'm choosing to receive tweets or Instagrams or Snapchats from certain sources and not others. My Facebook page is going to choose kind of for me certain things I'm going to see and not others, as opposed to, an era not that long ago when maybe you had one or two community newspapers that everybody read and had a common buy-in to at least this is important. Now, I may disagree with their take on it, or I may not agree with the editorial here, but I guess this was on page one, so I guess this is important. Or everybody watching Walter Cronkite or Tom Brokaw or Eric Severide, your three choices back in the day, and them, again, kind of saying, okay, hey, everybody, here's a half an hour's worth of really important things that happened today that you need to know. Well, social media are quite good at not bringing you there at all, right? And having you be sharing information with other like-minded folks who have similarly chosen, and things that disagree with that are unavailable.
Or at least a place for a healthy discourse, too. So you, even with your editorials, you had somebody who, you know, would write something that forced you to think about it from a different perspective, right? And that Facebook feed drives you to only really see that direction that you're headed and not someone else's perspective necessarily.
I think social media knows that this is up to some extent. I mean, I would look at the recent comments by Mark Zuckerberg indicating that, well, you know, we're reevaluating how the news feed is. For many critics who have come to these observations before, this is not new.
Right.
But he's coming around to it, and I think the involvement or at least the use of Facebook in the a recent 2016 presidential election and the attempts, as far as we know, of Russia to interfere there has really caused this awakening moment. But there are even organizations in Silicon Valley who are calling for, as the expression goes, time well spent, just to make sure that we understand that this thing is potentially, it's got its limits for the good it can do in terms of what kind of decisions we make.
You know, the genie's kind of out of the bottle on social media, and it's hard to imagine any organized force that would put the genie back in the bottle.
Right.
So I think what you see in professors like Amanda and Adam is an attempt to equip our students with skills and tools to cope with a world
right.
in which social media are ubiquitous. And for many, social media might be the primary or only media. Right? They aren't watching broadcast news or even CNN. They're, you know, both of my daughters don't even have, you know, rabbit ears. That's a technology we used to use when I was young to get television, or cable television, right? So they're consuming media in completely different ways than a dinosaur like I do, you know, where I have a cable subscription, and so I'm getting all this stuff in feeds. So what's great about, I would say, Winona State generally, but faculty like Adam and Amanda, is that they're trying to equip Winona State students for a world in which there are many forces that will try to short-circuit your critical thinking. And being attentive to that, be it from a social psychological perspective or being it from an argumentation perspective, being attentive to how we are inundated with these might give our students a kind of a fighting chance to navigate and make some sense out of the world. Mm-hmm. Because being uncritical about that, you won't be able to make sense out of the world. You'll just further burrow down like an ostrich putting their head in the sand and just perhaps be surprised when the world is not quite exactly the way you thought it was.
Right, right. Good point. That actually answered my next question of how we can maybe turn things around here, you know. In Hofstadter's...
Well, of course, we're three educators here, right? So, of course, our answer is just more education, right? More learning.
Right, right. But you have to have those tools.
And each of us,
right,
of course, from our own field is sort of saying, well, more of what my field brings to the table is really
right,
what's needed.
Right.
But happily, in this case, these are very much overlapping subsets of what we're talking about,
right,
and not contradictory at all.
Right.
And go to the heart of what universities are supposed to do anyway.
Yeah, yeah, okay. In Hofstadter's book, he said the greater part of the public has an ingrained distrust of eggheads, but also a genuine yearning for enlightenment and culture. Do you think that people still today still have that yearning for enlightenment and culture, even if anti-intellectualism is on the rise?
Absolutely. I think so. I think that our general human nature is to be curious about the world around us and to find ways to feed that curiosity. And I think one of, you know, as President Olson acknowledged, that one of our jobs as educators is to really provide an avenue for that curiosity and that avenue to seek that, you know, quote unquote, enlightenment, wherever that may be in whatever field that feeds, you know, that most desire to learn.
Okay. Do you think that desire to learn can be cultivated into an interest in, say, science or academia?
Oh, absolutely. How? You know, that's, I think, up to the field and up to the individual's pursuit of knowledge. But, I mean, absolutely. I think that as humans, we're innately curious about the world around us, and that area of curiosity differs from person to person. But that's part of the goal in exploring your different fields, is to really find where it is that you are most curious and able to find the answers that you're seeking.
Okay.
So I agree with that completely, but I think there is a countervailing force. And I'm not able here and now to cite my source on this, but I remember having read someplace, credible source, I just got to say that with the crew here, that sometimes further education doesn't always open us up to contrary ideas or argument. It merely makes us better at arguing our own, more eloquently argue the position we had held all along. And feel free to challenge me on that, because I cannot cite where I got that. But I think you know, so we, you know, academics tend to be verbal by nature and tend to be, let's say, more pithy, glib, and articulate than we're paid to be, and we're attracted to this profession because we are. So that's a danger, you know, that we just use more highfalutin, fancy words to say what we thought all along rather than actually be engaged, as I think we were tonight at the panel, with a true give and take, you know, not only between the three of us, but with an audience that didn't completely agree with us about everything, saw things differently. And I had the sense that we were perhaps embodying what it was we were saying we were going to embody. Sure. That was what was happening there.
Okay.
So I will throw out a name. So we got to, like, be careful of your toes. We'll drop a name right now. But so there's a media theorist in communication studies named Siva Vaidhyanathan, and he's got a book called The Googleization of Everything. Mm-hmm. And it's about how Google as a company kind of changes the way we think about knowledge and commerce and stuff like that. But he's got this great definition of education in it, which I like to come back to. And Siva says the definition of education is the encounter with that which you had never thought of before, that which you had not expected, or that which is just plain other, capital O, or otherness itself. And I think if we think about the things that really change the way we see the world, that definition is true. And so our habit as educators should be to try to, you know, sometimes it's through gentle encouragement and sometimes it's through immersion, but we've got to demonstrate otherness to people because the world is complicated and our perceptions are limited. And so if we think about education that way, you know, we've got a clear mission, right? Like a clear goal.
Okay, great. There have been many books written on this subject, but there's a comedic movie out there called Idiocracy, where society is dumbed down to the point of ridiculousness. Do you think that things could go that far where our whole society breaks down because of this? Or do you think it'll just kind of ebb and flow depending on our political climate or social consciousness? Or
I haven't seen that movie, so I couldn't comment on that. But okay. I think you could find quite a few movies and works of literature that are on that same general theme. When you said that, the one that came to mind was a short story by Kurt Vonnegut called Harrison Bergeron that I think is commonly read. And it's about kind of some near future society where kind of everything is driven toward mediocrity and everything has to be kind of level and kind of the illogical consequences that come from that. I have a lot of faith in the human spirit, and I have a whole lot of faith in what universities do. And the fact that institution, you know, Winona State's been here almost 160 years, and the type of institution we are goes back about 1,000 years to the University of Bologna and the University of Oxford. So this is endured a lot of really crazy stuff.
Right.
If you think about all maybe the horrible things that have happened in a 160-year time frame, you know, Hofstadter reacting to McCarthyism, World War II and the ugliness of anti-intellectualism, you know, that actually equated it with ethnicities and religious beliefs and so on, and the horrible consequences of that, and then go back 1,000 years, you know, and think of all that's happened. And yet here we still are, right?
Right.
So this is an enduring thing. And the human longing for the curiosity that Amanda mentioned, the human longing for understanding. And I mean, I think people kind of want to be in concordance with each other. I think it would be a more natural state. Mm-hmm. And maybe the reason why we're in conflict with some is actually to seek concord and harmony with others, right? And given all that, I guess I don't worry about a future where it's an, what do you call it, idiocracy?
Yeah.
All right, so we should go look at this movie? Is that what you're advocating?
You may or may not want to.
All right. Yeah, it sounds kind of discouraging.
It is discouraging.
Anyway, that's my take.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree. I think that was well said in that direction. I don't have anything more to add with that because it really harmonizes well.
Okay, great. Do you agree?
I do. I don't. I think Mike Judge is very good at sort of.
Is that a Mike Judge thing?
It is. It is a Mike Judge thing. Yeah,
Mike Judge, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the underlying premise is that people who are less intelligent have kids who are also less intelligent, and people who are intelligent have less kids. Therefore, you're outnumbered if you are intelligent. And so I'm really reluctant about the premise because I think that, you know, you're not really born into a fate. like that, you know, and like President Olson said, education can be a great intervention regardless of what your background is, and we can change the world to make it what we want it to be. But if you're, I mean, for dystopians, you know, some people look to WALL-E as right. sort of a view of the future, right. but...
That'd be in my short list of favorite Pixar movies.
Yeah, right. I would advocate if you want to think about dystopian as like just a warning, I'd go to Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men, which is based on a P.D. James book.
And a movie
but the movie is very different, but that one strikes more so at the idea that nationalism and almost like an aggressive tribalism could take over if we got too desperate, and you know, hopefully we do our work right, we can avoid that kind of stuff.
Okay, well said. Great. Well, I appreciate you all being with us today. We'll wrap it up here, and thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks again to Winona State University President Scott Olson, Professor of Psychology Amanda Brower, and Professor of Communication Studies Adam Gaffey for joining us today on Culture Click. I'm Bill Stoneberg, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.